So let me get the most difficult part of this right out of the way. Our prelude, Fanfare for the Common Man, was played at my brother's memorial. In 2008, at the Office of Naval Intelligence and the Center for Maritime Security, where he was second in command. The stress of that environment in post-9/11 America killed him. Dawn slowly overtakes the floodlights on the flight deck of USS Kitty Hawk. Steam seeps from the catapults, dissolving in tendrils, giving an otherworldly air to the always surreal scene that is the flight deck of a carrier. Red-shirted ordnancemen, ordies, load the last of the 500-pound bombs on the A-7 and A-6 bombers. F-14s receive their complement of AIM-9 heat-seeking missiles for planes and anti-radiation missiles to take out radar sites. Plane captains in their brown jerseys ready their charges for pilots and crew. The flight deck, always a tense and dangerous place during flight operations, is on this morning a bit more tense and dangerous than usual. This launch, only about 30 minutes away, is sending planes into Iran. Flight crews, finished with their mission briefing, are on their way to the flight deck. I am one of them. It was the summer of 1984. The Iran-Iraq war had escalated. The Ayatollah Khomeini's military had sunk a couple of oil tankers coming from Iraqi ports. The United States was going to put a stop to that. Kitty Hawk, on station in the Indian Ocean, was sending warplanes into Iran to take out U.S.-made weapons and planes, military hardware we sold Iran and trained Iranians to use under the rule of the Shah. I don't remember when we found out that we were part of a drill, a nearly full-scale practice, a fact known only to the Admiral and a few others. I do know that the 93 days I spent in the Indian Ocean that year, thinking about the possibility daily of flying into Iran, played a huge role in my decision to leave the Navy, an institution I had thought was going to be my career. I was lucky. I never had to drop bombs on people. I'll probably never know how close I came to being ordered to do that. It was a remote possibility, but I could have been asked to drop a nuclear bomb. We trained for that. At that time in my life, I would have dropped conventional weapons and would probably have dropped a nuclear weapon if I'd been ordered to do so. I am eternally grateful that that order never came. Homeless people that we serve on Saturday mornings, members of this congregation, were not as lucky as I. As originally enacted, Armistice Day commemorated the end of fighting between the Allies and Germany at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918. It was meant to honor and remember the dead of the Great War, only later known as World War I. Armistice Day was renamed Veterans Day in the United States after the Second World War. Today we rang our bell 11 times at the 11th hour on the 11th day of the month in remembrance of all those who have fought and died for our country. But we also remember those who have not died, who have returned home different than when they left, broken in body or spirit. It is those broken in spirit that are the subject of this sermon and the subject of the newly released book, Soul Repair, by Gabriella Latini, a professor of mine at Star King, and Rita Brock, and from whose book I draw some of my material. Camilo Mejia found himself holding a rooftop position against a crowd of protesters in Iraq. A young male Iraqi below him brandished what looked like a grenade. Camille was ordered to shoot. He has no memory of shooting, but does remember seeing the young man dead in a pool of blood. Alone later, he counted his shells. He had fired 11 times. He was appalled that his ability to decide, to make a conscious decision, had been overcome by his training. He writes, "Nothing ever prepares you for what that does to you as a human being. To kill an innocent person. Nothing is going to prepare you for the level of destruction you bring upon a nation and you bring upon yourself for being part of it." Moral injury occurs when we do something counter to our deepest moral convictions. It turns out that soldiers can be trained to kill, but that for most, this killing comes at a terrible price. It doesn't matter much whether the killing takes place in a just war, such as World War II, or in the incredibly dangerous and confusing theaters of most wars since, and including Vietnam. In these wars, anything, anyone, and everything may be about to kill you, including women, children, and animals. Post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, has become recognized as a widespread medical issue in our returning veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq. PTSD is a physiological response in the brain to extreme trauma or danger. Among other symptoms, later events can trigger flashbacks. PTSD is clinically treatable, but it is not moral injury, although there is much confusion in the literature and in the military about this. Moral injury occurs when an individual violates their most deeply held moral convictions, something which soldiers are asked and trained to do. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not kill is the core moral tenet of every major religion in the world and is deeply embedded in the souls of all of us. To violate this tenet, no matter how justified, causes irreparable damage. When there is doubt about the justification, the damage only grows worse. Again, Camilo Mejia's words, PTSD is a breach of trust with the world. Moral injury is a violation of the moral agreement I had with my internal world. As we heard from Andy, many Unitarian Universalists have conflicted feelings about war and the soldiers who fight them. Those only a few years older than I were often among the protesters and conscientious objectors to the Vietnam War. Later generations of UUs have protested the more recent wars. Coming from this background, we often don't know how to treat our veterans and how to treat the active duty military among us. Oh, it's easy to admire our World War II vets or even our Korean War vets, but what about Vietnam? The two Iraq wars, our longest ever war in Afghanistan. In our minds and internationally, these wars, possibly excepting the first Gulf War, do not stand up to accepted standards for just war. Our ambivalence towards the men and women who fought and fight these wars is palpable. But I think our ambivalence may be helped by better knowing who are our soldiers. We can get clearer on this by understanding why people join our volunteer military. People join out of a sense of duty, love of country, patriotism. These are not bad things. They are looking for a purpose and a higher calling than our consumer-driven culture can provide. At its best, the military can provide these things, and military recruiting materials play this aspect well. It's difficult for most young persons to understand the dark side of a war, the dark side of war, when inundated with propaganda and popular culture which says otherwise. I joined out of a sense of higher purpose, of wanting to serve my country. When I became disillusioned with the mission and left the military, it took me decades and several false starts to again find a sense of higher calling and mission. People also join for income, for structure, for free education, for stability. Studies have shown that the military is a way out for the disadvantaged among us, and that the disadvantaged in our society are disproportionately represented in the military. While certainly not disadvantaged, I also joined for economic reasons. A Navy ROTC scholarship was my ticket to the otherwise unaffordable Ivy League college I wanted to attend. And finally, there is a strong American myth of regeneration through violence. There was a time in my life when I truly believed that I could never reach my highest potential without being tested in battle. This myth is perpetuated in some of our most successful movies. I understand that Top Gun, first released when I was in active duty in the 80s, is being refilmed. It wasn't good the first time, but it did make money. Movies and documentaries which examine the true personal costs of war do not do well at the box office. Films such as The Ground Truth, Lioness, In the Valley of Elijah, and Stop Loss are not titles that jump quickly to our tongues. Let There Be Light, the final part of a trilogy commissioned by the Army during World War II, followed the struggles of veterans in a military hospital. While there were heroic stories, there were also stories of moral anguish and brokenness. The film was suppressed by the Army until 1981, for 35 years, because broken soldiers do not fit in the Army myth. The veteran suffering from moral injury experiences a collapse of meaning and sometimes a loss of will to live. Coming home and healing are difficult, complex, and dangerous. Vietnam vet and philosopher Camille Obika writes in his poem, Warrior's Dance, I am no longer alien to this horror. I am no longer alien to this horror. I am the horror. I have lost my humanity and have embraced the insanity of war. The monster and I are one. The blood of innocence forever stains my soul. The transformation is complete, and I can never return. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. Returning to parades and celebrations, to a culture of consumerism, celebrity worship, casual commitment, offers the vet no purpose worth pursuing. Veterans find that they cannot relate their experiences except with others who have experienced what they did. In the words of Tyler Boudreau, another vet, one's humanity can be quite difficult to recover once ejected. Those suffering from moral injury count significantly among our homeless. The National Coalition for Homeless estimates that between 1/5 and 1/4 of our homeless population are veterans. Think about that. 50 to 60 of the people that we feed every Saturday morning are veterans. What's wrong with that? That they're homeless. Suicide among active duty military is reaching epidemic proportions. In a front page article on August 17th, the Christian Science Monitor described how in July, there were 31 suicides of active duty military, the greatest number ever. 301 military personnel took their lives in 2011. And in 2012, the pace is greater. We have members of this congregation, veterans of wars from World War II forward, who suffer from moral injury. They struggle with what they have done in war. To a large degree, this is invisible to the rest of us. They don't generally talk about their experiences and their internal conflict. They are coping better than our homeless vets, for whatever reasons. This doesn't mean they don't struggle. What can we do? What can we do as a liberal religion? I think there are several things we can do at both the societal and at the personal level. The soldier comes to recognize, if not in the moment, then later, that the enemy they have killed is also human, this despite their training. This is more than we have been able to do as a society, where the enemy is still other than human. It is incumbent on us to counteract any talk that dehumanizes the enemy, as ubiquitous as it is. The enemy as other runs completely counter to our first principle. To our first principle, where we affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Every person. While there may sometimes be reasons that justify going to war, it is incumbent on us to be a voice of reason, a voice that offers up the true costs of any war, the cost to our young men and women who do the fighting and to their families and to society as a whole. The military-industrial juggernaut is a powerful force. What would it be like to hold our leaders accountable for warmongering, for fearmongering, for war crimes committed under their watch? And what do we do at a personal level? I read in Soul Repair that many veterans don't really know what to do with the statement, "Thank you for your service," when they are so deeply conflicted about their service and the meaning of it. Don't offer forgiveness. Forgiveness is not ours to give who have not known the horrors of combat. Forgiveness is between the veteran and his Almighty. If you know families of vets, ask how you can support them because they struggle. Do listen. If you are lucky enough to have a vet share any of their story with you, just listen. Don't judge, don't console, just listen. Having their story heard is an important part of their healing. Be compassionate. When a vet is having a bad day, a bad week, a bad month, put it in context. And remember, among the homeless that we feed, this important work that this congregation does, any one of those people you are serving could be a vet. And a large percentage of them are vets. And to this, on this day, when the guns were silenced in Europe 94 years ago, I say amen.